Welcome to Virtually Speaking Science. It is Wednesday, February 25, 2015. We are hosted in Second Life by the Exploratorium, where we are joined by a digitally present studio audience who comment and pose questions in real time. Our host today is Kelly Hills, ethicist, professional editor, and writer in the medical sciences and humanities. Kelly publishes her current ethics-focused commentaries, where she considers the ethical, legal, and social implications of emerging technologies, DIY biotech, clinical medicine, and public health on her blog, Life as an Extreme Sport. Today, Kelly talks with Harvard Law's Glenn Cohen, a leading expert on the intersection of bioethics and the law. Glenn spent a year as a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, writing Patients with Passports, Medical Tourism, Law, and Ethics, the first comprehensive analysis of the legal and ethical issues raised by medical tourism. He is a professor at Harvard Law School, where he is also co-director of the Petrie Flom Center for Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics. Many of the books discussed on Virtually Speaking Science can be found at the Exploratorium's online bookstore. We hope you'll take a look. And with that, we're over to you, Kelly.
Good evening, everyone. As Sherry noted, my guest tonight is Glenn Cohen. He is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, director of all kinds of interesting things, health law policy, biotech, bioethics at the Petrie Flom Center. He is by far one of the leading, if not only, experts on the intersection of bioethics, healthcare, and the law. You can go to Google Scholar and just type in his name, and you'll see all kinds of stuff. Interesting also little tidbit in there. Glenn has been working on injury to NFL players and translational research and stuff like that, which is all kinds of fascinating and I didn't know about until about 20 minutes before the show started. So that's not what we're planning on talking about tonight, but we may have to have him come back and talk about that as the NFL releases more and more on their concussion and player safety data. So tonight we're going to be talking about Glenn's book, Patients with Passports, Medical Tourism, Law, and Ethics. And it is a fascinating book. It's by put out by the Oxford University Press, and it's accessible, written for the layperson to read. It's got lots of interesting legal, ethical tidbits in it, and it's relatively up-to-date, which is not actually something you can often say when we're talking about bioethical literature. So, thank you for being here tonight, Glenn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
It's really nice to have you here. So, before we get started about the book and medical tourism and the legal side and the unethical side, let's go a little bit into how you got to where you are, because I know that whenever I talk about bioethics, whenever my husband Nick talks about bioethics, basically whenever anyone says bioethics, I'd say 80% of the time people's eyes kind of glaze over and they go, what the hell is that? And so everyone's always interested in how you get there and how you found your way there. And for me personally, I find it fascinating because everybody has a different path to getting where they are. So how in the world did a law dude end up doing health law policy, biotech, and bioethics?
So it's a good question. So one of the secrets is that it started before I became a law dude. I grew up in Canada. I'm from Montreal originally. And Canadians in general are obsessed with healthcare and health policy in a way that's only become kind of palpable in the U.S. in the last few years with the Affordable Care Act. Even then, not every election, it's issue number one or two. And actually, believe it or not, I know exactly the first time I heard the word bioethics. I was in grade five, I think, at a party at someone's house. It was kind of a nerdy party. I was a nerdy person, and we were playing Risk. And somebody's sister, who was a medical student, came in and said that she was taking a course in the subject. I never heard the word. I'm like, boy, that's really fascinating. And when I got to university, I went to University of Toronto, they had a program within the philosophy department in applied ethics, and particularly bioethics. And this is, you know, quite a ways ago. So they deserve credit for having a program back then. So I became very interested in this. And when I got to law school, there weren't a lot of people working in these areas. We had a law and psychiatry class. We had a health law class. Michael Sandel, of course, he taught a markets and morals class, but I kind of created a lot of opportunities to do some independent writing. And then I went out after law school. I spent a year with a judge. I spent a couple years as a appellate lawyer at the Justice Department, mostly defending the president and the agencies in common law matters and admin law matters, constitutional law and administrative law. But I had a case or two that I got to handle that were bioethical, including the Abigail Alliance case about access to, by terminally ill patients to drugs that are experimental that have cleared phase one but not gone through phase two yet. So, you know, this rekindled my interest to some extent, and I always thought maybe I'd want to be an academic at some point. And the Petrie Flom Center that I now direct was created while I was in practice, and I was hinted at by some former mentors of mine, why don't you come back and be a fellow here? And I did. And since then, I've been able to do the work that I love, teach great students, and have great collaboration. So it's been terrific.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. So kind of practicing law, the Abigail Alliance case, and then so it sounds like you made the shift at some point while you were practicing law into practicing law in America.
Yeah, exactly. Which, I came to law school at Harvard. I kept thinking it every time along the way, I thought I was going to go back to Canada, including when I took my current job. But each time there's been an opportunity that's just been really exciting, and I stay. And now I'm pretty close to having – I have a green card now. I'll be a resident, a citizen if I want to, relatively soon. And it's a hard job to leave, so I don't see myself going back. But I do spend a lot of time back in Canada, and I collaborate with hospitals there and the government and stuff like that. So that's been
Canada has – yeah, Canada has a very different bioethics scene than the American bioethics scene. We at least – we do have multiple centers now working, and it seems like it's a much quieter field still in Canada. I know there's Toronto, and obviously there's Dalhousie, but outside of that, it seems well. And I guess I shouldn't knock the neuroethics folks on the West Coast, but as a whole, Canada does seem to be much smaller and a little bit just smaller of a field. And I can see how. I have other Canadian bioethics friends, and they all say the same thing. They're all in America. They're all working in America. They all keep thinking they're going to go back to Canada, and yet they all keep staying in America. It's interesting.
Well, I think
actually,
it's interesting. Go ahead. I was going to say that one thing that's interesting is that the Canadian Supreme Court just decided an assisted suicide case a couple weeks ago. In the States, it seems as though most bioethical issues are heavily the sites of contestation between comprehensive moral views or public policy or even, legislative and executive politics. And that's not true in Canada. So I think bioethical issues, you know, the issues that are at the forefront often have to do with kind of questions of rationing and justice, not so much, you know, abortion and the like as in this country.
Yeah, it's I'm definitely been getting a feel for the multinational bioethics scene in the last couple of years, and every country does have its own interests. And honestly, I think part of it probably too is the publishing sphere is very biased towards American bioethics at the moment. And so that certainly creates an interesting tilt in the perspective of what who's doing what at any given time. Excuse me, Root Beer's coming back to speak to us. I normally switch to beer or wine right before one of the shows, just because, frankly, it's a quieter drink to have, and didn't get out of the house today. So, apologies, everyone.
No worries.
So. You're at Harvard. You're running your own center now, which is really awesome. I can speak to the fact that I know he's putting out some great students. One of them is down here in Pennsylvania right now. Candace is doing great by all accounts. And you're also working as an editor of books and as a journal of law and the biosciences. And then you decided to do this book on patients with passports. So how do you go from being a con law professor and bioethics interests from the Abigail Alliance case and things like that, to writing, and with a pretty significant background at this point, in medical tourism.
Yeah, so I got interested in this literally by watching TV. I watched a lot of television, and CNN had about a four-minute segment. This is like 6 years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, something around there. A six-minute segment on medical tourism. And I thought to myself, gosh, this is really fascinating what's been written on it. And something came out while I was starting to do the first paper I did on this by my friend, now a really good colleague, Nathan Cortez, who wrote the first, I think, big law paper on the subject. But I kind of became fascinated, and I started by thinking I was going to write one article on the subject, but one article became two, became three, became four, became five. And at some point I realized that in order to kind of treat this properly, I needed to have the space of a book and the time for a book, and also to travel and see some of the places where medical tourism was being done with my own eyes. So the Radcliffe Institute, I got a fellowship there, and that really gave me the time to work intensively on this this book, which really tries to, you know, describe. So even just as you said in your introduction, the descriptive piece is quite something in and of itself, and that there's a lot of writing on it, but not a lot of good data, and trying to find out what data to rely on versus not. What kinds of claims you'll make that's puffery versus has to be backed with actual, you know, morbidity and mortality data. So just collecting in each of the chapters, the descriptive piece turned out to be a big undertaking. And then working through and arguing with people the more normative side was also a lot of fun.
Yeah, oh, shocking. Lawyers and bioethicists, the people who love to argue most at any dinner party. Actually, one of the things that is really interesting, so maybe we should go into a little bit about what medical tourism is, just to get all of our audience up to date. How would you describe medical tourism? Because it is such a big field at the time.
So I would define it as people who travel from one country, what we call the home country, to another country, the destination country, for the primary purpose of securing health care. And I put it that way because it excludes people who are abroad for business or for vacation and get sick. I think of that as incidental care. These are people who are kind of directed. And then I think it's useful to kind of divide that big world into smaller chunks. One way of dividing it is between people who travel for things that are legal in the home country and legal where they're going, people who travel for things like hip replacements, heart valve, that kind of stuff, plastic surgery, people who travel for things that are illegal in both places, of which transplant tourism for kidneys is the best example, and then what I call circumvention tourism, this mixed cases where it's illegal where you're coming from but legal where you're going. So travel for abortion, for assisted suicide, some forms of fertility tourism, some forms of stem cell tourism as well. So, you know, the book tries to kind of cover all of that, which is a big undertaking. And there are other ways to divide in the world, but I use that as the kind of the first slice.
Yeah, and I think that, personally, I really like the way you describe it because it's very, it is very non-judgmental. There's no moral statement bound up in it. There's nothing other than, you know, home country, destination country, and then it really does let you narrow in on each individual case because there are so many various details that can come out, whether it's something as simple, quote, simple as going to, you know, a relatively developed hospital in Germany or Costa Rica for something that might cost, you know, $55,000 in America versus $5,000 somewhere else and is perfectly legal, like a hip transplant, versus, say, surrogacy issues, which in some countries are incredibly illegal and others not so much, versus stem cell tourism versus, you know, it gives it a nice broad umbrella so that you can then start going down the spokes to discussing the law and the ethics. And as a lot of my regular listeners will know, one of my favorite sayings is just because it's legal doesn't mean it's ethical. Just because it's ethical doesn't mean it's legal. And
I couldn't agree more. So I think it's also interesting, you know, to think about the different people who are paying and who are, there's a lot of money flowing through this system. It's kind of remarkable. And, you know, in the U.S., at least, some insurers and employers, it has to be self-insured employers because of lots of insurance regulation, are starting to give people checks, actually, to go abroad. Mm-hmm. So not only will they waive your deductible and your copay, not only will they pay, give you paid leave and pay for a companion to go, but they'll give you a check for $3,000 for a gastric bypass to go to Costa Rica. And the reason is, as you say, that often, even from the insurer price, you're saving 50% of the cost by going abroad. If you're paying out of pocket, you're saving something more like 80% of the cost. So it's kind of dramatic, but it creates all sorts of interesting questions about agency, about who's benefiting, mm-hmm. about what our impact is on the developing world. So I think it's a really interesting thing to talk about and to write about. Hopefully the readers think so too.
Well, I think that's a great example, and it's possibly a little less ethically fraught as some of the other ones we could get into. But with the getting a check and paid time off and transit to and from Costa Rica for yourself and a companion for gastric bypass, all of these things, suddenly it seems like we have to ask not only about the safety of the hospital that will be doing the procedure and the aftercare and all of the things you might normally consider when you're just evaluating whether or not you're going to have a surgery to begin with, but you also have to start thinking about things like coercion. If you're offering somebody $5,000 check plus all of the benefits that, let's be honest, some of us don't get that with our normal 9-to-5 jobs. You know, I certainly wouldn't get several weeks off to recover, not to mention money to have somebody else stay with me and all of these things if I was to have surgery here in the States. Nor would I get a nice big check to go with it. And now suddenly that's happening. And so it's another element entirely to taking it beyond just medical necessity or not.
Yeah, here I think it's interesting to think of, well, to think also about the grounds of choice. So we're currently the biggest population of Americans from what we know, and again, the data here is not as robust as you would want. This turns out to be hard to measure. I mean, there have been some studies about actually going to airports and asking people why they're leaving the country, but otherwise it's hard to measure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the biggest population has so far been uninsured individuals, and there, in some mm-hmm. ways, they face a different kind of coercion, which is they can't, for an elective surgery, they can't afforded in the United States if they're going to pay, you know,
right.
$200,000 for something. And so they feel coerced in some ways by the existing structure of reimbursement and of the like.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them, those were, I think, the first wave. But now we have this second and third wave of medical tourists where insurers are saying, you know, why should the baseline or maybe the default, but why should the only way we do this be that you see a doctor in the United States? If it turns out
mm-hmm.
that, you know, we can save a lot of money, give some of that benefit that we have, share it with you. And as you say, the hospital checks out in terms of morbidity and mortality. It checks out in terms of follow-up care and the ability to do good follow-up care. Maybe it checks out in terms of what the impacts are on the developing country you're going to. Is there something coercive about this offer? And as you know, there's a huge bioethics discourse on when is an offer coercive, when is it exploitative. And, you know, my own views here are I'm more concerned about the information condition, about whether people are given good information about these hospitals when they're making their choices,
mm-hmm.
whether also agency questions, whether the insurer or the employer, their incentives to choose a good hospital, because in some ways they're a much more sophisticated player compared to individual patients. But are their incentives
right.
aligned with the incentives of the patient? And are there ways the law could make them better aligned? You know, so I think that I'm not somebody who comes away. I mean, some people, when they ask me about this book, they want to say, okay, medical tourism, is it good or is it bad? And I think that's just very the wrong way to think about it. Instead, I say it's something very interesting. There's a lot of benefits here, and there are some things that are concerning, and the question is whether you could imagine a regulatory structure or other kinds of interventions that reduce the dark sides of the industry but have some of its benefits?
So we have a question from one of our audience members in Second Life who wants to know what are the liabilities if somebody dies overseas? How does that work?
So,
and I know you have an entire chapter on this in your book.
Exactly. So I'll give the short version. I also teach civil
yes.
procedure for the first year, so I can do this in depth. The short answer
okay.
is if you travel abroad, especially if you pay out of pocket and just go abroad and something bad happens to you in Thailand or India or Mexico, you're going to have a very tough time suing in medical malpractice, recovering in medical malpractice, as compared to the same treatment in the U.S. And the problem is it's hard to get foreign hospitals to come into U.S. courts and to get jurisdiction over them. Probably the law that's going to apply is Thai or Mexico or Indian law, depending on where the treatment takes place. That law is much less remunerative than U.S. law, and there are a host of other problems you face. So I tell people they have a couple of options. One is to look for a hospital that is willing to agree to arbitrate or otherwise agree to be sued in U.S. court. The other is that there's some insurance products. I believe Lloyd's of London had a policy for some time where there are products that can allow you to buy insurance as against something bad happening. And that insurance, even when you – because the cost savings are so large, the cost of that insurance is usually small compared to how much you're saving, and it can be a way to kind of secure yourself. But all that said, you know, it's great to be able to sue. I'm a lawyer. Great to be able to sue and be compensated on the back end, and it's great that lawsuits can deter, but ideally nobody wants to be hurt. And the first order question, the hard thing, is figuring out what are the morbidity, mortality, and the like for the various hospitals you might go to.
And so I know you collected some of that data when it was available for your book. How in the world did you even go about doing that? Because everybody collects it differently. We have a hard enough time even in countries like Canada or Australia that have, you know, socialized health, as the Americans would put it, collecting this kind of data on an accurate and consistent scale. How do you do that internationally?
So you're absolutely right. It's very difficult. I mean, even within a country like Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, right? Pennsylvania has a report card system for cardiac stuff. And
yep.
there's all sorts of controversies about whether it causes people to cream skim doctors to see only easy cases, other ways in which it distorts practice and the like. There have been some good studies done where hospitals have been willing to turn over their records, to researchers trained in comparing hospitals, and they can compare it to a place like Mayo. But that's really the exception. There are some countries like Malaysia, for example, where the medical tourism industry and the healthcare industry is heavily government run, and they have a lot of access to data, and they've been relatively transparent about it. But for the most part, there's a lot of buyer beware here, and it's very hard to get this data disclosed to you. Even if you have the data, it's very hard to know what to compare it to when you're making decision. So a big piece of the book is talking about how this could be made better and what kinds of levers we have to give incentives to make it better, including, for example, the federal government coming in and saying, if you want to have insurers or employers be able to send people abroad to your hospital, you need to disclose this information in this form and not just disclose it to the employer and the insurer, but disclose it quite publicly in a way that can be understood. So that would be ideal. The second best, what people use as rules of thumbs, are accreditation. The biggest accreditation system is known as Joint Commission International. It's related to the Joint Commission that accredits U.S. hospitals for Medicaid, Medicare. And they accredit based on, like, you know, procedures, what you have in place, care team, and that kind of size. And that's good. It's better than nothing, but it's not really kind of based on outcome data, which is what you would probably want as a patient. So
yeah, I would think so, at least. I wouldn't want to go somewhere if they had a real bad success rate of, say, heart transplants or whatever. Admittedly, that gets into the organ donation stuff too, but so hip replacement. You know, you want to know that the place you're going not only can do the surgery, but also that say the people who are receiving aftercare aren't coming down with some kind of nasty antibiotic-resistant drug or bacteria while they're in the hospital, and that they're getting decent aftercare and stuff like that. And it just seems like those are the kind of things that, at least as an American, I'm certainly accustomed at looking at when I choose hospitals for procedures or anything like that. And it, I admit the idea of just trying to use the internet to figure out what's best in Costa Rica or India or Thailand, it kind of makes me a little hanky, you know? It makes my skin crawl, just a little.
And there is a kind of an intermediary industry, which are sometimes go by the names facilitators. And these are people, it's interesting, it's kind of a hybrid between a travel agent on the one hand and kind of a hospitalist on the other. And one of the things interesting I learned in the book is that many of them are paid referral fees to the hospitals to which they refer, not all of them, many of them don't, and they won't disclose that to you. The other, I'll just tell one story about this, is that of all the things I learned in this book, this was the thing that I think made me laugh the most and thought was the most interesting, is that often these facilitators take on almost familial roles in the lives of people. So I was told by one set of researchers from the UK who do focus group qualitative research kind of stuff, that in Australia there was a facilitator who'd had breast augmentation, I can't remember where it took place, and then became herself, after being a patient, a facilitator. And she organized groups of Australian women to come to get breast augmentation together, and she would like check in on them, and she organized social hours. And they referred to her as, I'm not joking, their boobie mommy. And when they got back, years afterwards, they still got together and celebrated what was called their boobie birthday, the days that they did this. So this is just to say there's a really interesting mixing of many things in that story, but commerce and care and familial relationships and social relationships into this really very unique sort of phenomenon.
When my husband stops laughing, he might actually get that information, but he did actually want to point out that Australia's fifth largest health insurer is actually rolling out medical tourism insurance. So it definitely is a much bigger thing in countries that might actually be more open to medical tourism, in part because of how their medical structure is set up, also because of where they're located. You know, Australia, pretty close to a lot of the medical tourism destination places to begin with. And so it's a lot easier to talk about flying to Thailand for medical treatment when you're in Australia versus when you're in the East Coast of the United States. And I'm sure that probably at least to some degree affects how people think about it to begin with.
There's a lot of also cultural elements to it. People tend to return to places of their ethnic ancestry, even if they've never been there, and places where they speak the language. And there's a lot of catering, which is very interesting. So in Thailand, in Bumrungrad, I believe they have a wing that is perfectly halal, right? All the food is halal.
Right.
To attract Muslim, particularly Gulf patients.
Well, and that's something that I don't think we really consider a lot when we're talking about medical tourism, at least when I see it on CNN or other news channels or when it pops up. And you know, you pointed out it's been in the news a lot lately just because a lot of stuff's been going on in the last couple of weeks with medicine. You know, Canada doing their assisted suicide laws, the Thai surrogacy ruling just happened recently. There's been a couple of other things. Whenever I see it come up, though, I don't actually see people talking about the fact that medical tourism actually also includes people coming from another country to America. And
that's right.
Yet many American hospitals have huge medical tourism wings, or are known, and I'm not going to name names because I don't want to have any PR people yelling at me later on Twitter, but there are some hospitals that are very well known for shutting down entire wings because Saudi families have come in and are taking services and things like that. So it's certainly something where people come from other places to America, too. We're just as involved in medical tourism as anywhere else.
Absolutely. We are, we're for the long time, probably still are, the number one destination for high-tech, high-cost care. When money is no object, the U.S. is the place people go, and which is very interesting to think that people are coming here, and we're also sending people abroad at the same time, which reflects in some ways, I think, some of the, you know, inequalities in the U.S. healthcare system.
Well, and when you talk about inequalities, I mean, yes, certainly in the American system, and it seems like we've had nothing but conversation about that for the last couple of years as the Affordable Care Act has been rolled out and then tried to unroll out and then on and on, which is, of course, just going to go on and on as we go through the election season. But it seems like the inequality needs to be really something that's talked about on the global level, because don't we risk creating an unequal system of access when we're exporting to other places? What happens to the people who live in those places?
Yeah, exactly. So I've got a chapter of the book devoted to just this question. And again, it turns out to be a hard thing to answer, and it's useful to distinguish two separate questions. One is just the mere fact of inequality. Does medical tourism result in unequal care for the tourists compared to the people on the ground, the local population of a place like India? And there the answer is easy. Absolutely, the case. You know, the harder question, I think, is to ask whether it worsens inequalities and can you measure that? And I think my own view is that the evidence base is suggestive. It's not perfect, but it's suggestive, in particular in giving incentives for physicians to move from public sector facilities into private sector, internal brain drain, and also from reinvestment by the country away from public health measures towards land grants and support for high-tech medicine. And once you think this effect is happening, as in the book, you then have to struggle from an ethical point of view to ask what is the responsibility of an individual American or other Western tourist? What is the responsibility of the U.S. government when it looks at this trade? How do we think about the fact that our markets are now interlocked and the fact that we are not supplying as much health care as uninsured individuals need in the U.S. is causing them to go abroad, which itself has an effect on and worsens inequalities in a place like India, for example. So are acts of omission causing further inequalities there? And, you know, in the book, this is a chapter, I think, that veers off into the more philosophical side of this. I try to struggle with kind of leading theories of global justice and what they might have to say about this kind of uptrade and this kind of movement.
Yeah, I flashed back to Peter Singer and
Pogge.
Pogge and, yeah, everybody. Daniels. it's an interesting question because a lot of people have answers, but I'm not sure anybody has an answer yet that everybody can kind of, if not agree with, be okay with.
Yeah, and I mean, I think especially if you're not a robust cosmopolitan, I mean, the way I think of the question is, how cosmopolitan do you have to be before you think that there are enforceable duties? I mean, this is not Nagel's example of the shirt maker in one place and somewhere else where it's it's very disconnected. The connections here are much more are more direct than that. Now, are they as direct as stealing resources or poaching doctors, for example? Good question, a good, interesting set of questions. So I think about this as kind of a gradient of cosmopolitanism to statism and try to figure out where you have to be on the gradient before you start getting worried about this trade.
Yeah, and I've heard some people make the argument that in places like Costa Rica, one of the benefits of medical tourism is the fact that it's actually preventing brain drain, because a lot of developing world countries have a problem where their very highly educated doctors, who are very frequently educated in Canada, America, or Europe, then end up staying where they were educated and practicing there, and that the growing medical tourism market actually means people, doctors, are returning to these countries where they're from and, you know, operating and running medical tourism clinics, but at the same time are able to also offer services to the local population. I think sometimes that's a little fairy tale utopian wanting to look at it, but
it definitely happens, and the question is about the magnitudes of the two vectors. The other complicated thing is it means when they come home, they're not sending remittances, right? So we have to subtract that money, although that money is usually privately held rather than publicly held, And then it may also worsen interregional brain drain. So, from neighboring countries. So the dynamics are complicated here, both as just a descriptive matter to say, what is the effect this is really having? And then once you map it, trying to say, okay, well, now who's responsible for what? The two are both challenging, and I struggle with it in the chapter in the book, do my best, but don't think I have the magic bullet to cut through either the descriptive or the normative side of it.
Well, and it's I think it's timely because a lot of these things, even 40 years ago, 30 years ago, you know, it might have been an interesting theoretical question, but now borders are so flexible and impermeable, and you can get just about anywhere in the world inside 24 hours. And the notion of just a border stopping things has kind of started to become erased, and it is becoming a much more global world. And normally when you hear people talk about that, they're talking about the global economy in terms of goods being sent around the world or food, but it seems like it's important to acknowledge that we are actually talking not just about people in terms of resources, but people in terms of medicine and practice going all over, and that's going to change things. And we do have to start wrestling with these very complicated questions about ought and good and right.
Yeah, and then when you try to put it into practice, you also reach the situation to ask yourself what your sphere of influence is as a pragmatic matter, right? Even if so, for example, just to take an example from another part of the book, another part of what I know we're going to talk about, if you're of the view that if you prevent women from, you outlaw surrogacy, by doing so you deprive some women of an economic opportunity they would have otherwise had that they want, some people say that you're responsible then for redistributing towards them in a way that kind of mitigates some of the lost opportunity for them. And that's something you can theoretically do within a polity, within the United States, for example. But when you imagine the U.S. or France trying to discourage commercial surrogacy to India, in what way can the French government, try to make up the difference to some of these women? It becomes much more complex on the international scale, just implementing what you think is the right policy.
So I guess before we kind of transition into the more illegal stuff, talking about right policies and things like that, a place a lot of Americans still look at for medical advice is the American Medical Association. And have they weighed in recently on medical tourism? The last thing I'm familiar with is probably from 2008, when they just kind of tossed out some brief patient safety guidelines.
I mean, I think that's more or less relatively up to date. I mean, in general, they've been relatively hostile to it. And I think part of it is coming from a good place, which is the notion that they want to protect patients and the like. Part of it also, though, is probably coming from an anti-competitive place, which might be good or less good, depending on your view. But, you know, it's very interesting to think about this, that some of the few places where we've had reports of very public reports, like the Hannaford supermarket chain in the northeast of the United States, when they announced they were going to start sending people abroad, their local insurer kind of raced to try to match the rates in a way. So we had this competitive pressure from abroad. And I think that American medicine is understandably worried about competing not just with the hospital in the local market, but the idea of competing with a hospital in India, which currently is 20% the cost of what you charge, that's a terrifying prospect. Now, it's never going to be the case in the foreseeable future. I mean, such a small percentage of Americans have passports that I think tons of Americans are going to go over. But medical tourism, one of the things that's interesting about it, it has very strong price transparency. You can know what you're going to pay in India and Thailand right away, whereas in the U.S. it's very hard to get even price data ahead of time. So I think that's been an interesting challenge and an interesting kind of dialogue in some ways, and maybe a dialogue that the AMA is not so eager to have, but I don't want to cast aspersions on them. They're good people. I don't know exactly why they've taken this position, but it doesn't seem to me entirely implausible that if I were the AMA, I would be worried about this.
Yeah, I think that it's one of those things where you can probably see both sides, and since neither of us are AMA members, it's relatively easy just to kind of shrug and go, eh. So the thing that I know everyone always talks about with medical tourism in particular, and it's what you see in America most of the time on the news, is the illegal stuff.